You can be espousing any religion, but if you're really doing the inner inconvenient work of becoming a more developed human being, more Christ-like, Buddha-like, Elohim-like, Allah-like, if you're doing that inner inconvenient work and you're of service to God's creation, you're a Sufi.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn. This week on In Good Faith, we're talking to somebody who really gets interfaith. In fact, you just feel the passion that he has for this. This is Imam Jamal Rahman. He's in Seattle, and we're going to talk about this fabulous interfaith space that he is involved with. Heather Bigley is our senior producer in studio here today.
Hello.
Also, Aliyah Ebert.
Hey, everyone.
His enthusiasm is just contagious to me.
And so many quotes from Rumi. So
we like that.
I loved it, actually. There were so many lovely moments where I was like writing down.
And no matter what your denomination is or isn't, you might find out, besides what you think you are, you're also a Sufi.
Yes. Imam Rahman is a part of a group called the Interfaith Amigos and is the co-founder and imam at Interfaith Community Sanctuary. And he's adjunct faculty at Seattle University and a Sufi, which we get to talk a lot about in this episode.
The imam spoke to me from this beautiful building that's an interesting interfaith space shared by different faiths. And so I asked him how that came to be.
We actually own a historic church building, which we have converted into what we call Interfaith Community Sanctuary. And here we have an interfaith group. We have Muslims, we have Jews, we have Christians, we have Hindus, Buddhists, Wiccans, and also, not to forget, a very large segment, which is probably the most popular segment emerging in this country, spiritual but not religious. I'm in the prayer room. The gold wall you see behind me is actually what we call the Qibla. This is in the direction of Mecca. So when we pray in this prayer room, we pray in this direction. But however, this prayer room is used by Jews, by Christians, Hindus, or as a meditation place also. And what is very amazing, Steve, is that this place was given to us for free. It's a historical church building. We were a group, we called ourselves the Circle of Love. For 7 years, I forget when we started exactly, but for 7 years, we used to have classes, retreats, workshops in different people's homes. So the people in this church before us, they had heard about us. They invited us, and they were an aging group. I guess they were my age, at my stage of my life. And they said, you know, we'd like to hand this church over to another group because we are aging, the mortgage is paid, we have some money owing for repairs and things like that. We've heard about you. They tested us. They had us come and speak. They got to know us. They said, here is the church. Be responsible. So our knees are scraped with gratitude, Steve.
What a beautiful gift, a beautiful offer to the community.
Yes, and it's a historic building. It was built in 1890, which for Seattle is old.
So not only were you involved in interfaith work, but you did it with a couple of specific community religious leaders. And together you became known as the Interfaith Amigos. So tell me about that.
When 9/11 happened, there was a lot of agitation. You might call it Islamophobia. And at that time, we realized in 2001 that, you know, we don't know enough about the other's religion. We are tribal. We can have little get-togethers once or twice a year. And, you know, the common complaint is when those infrequent gatherings happened, the conversation was absurdly nice. The behavior was absurdly nice. But when people went back home, Muslims became terrorists, Jews became occupiers, Christians became liars. So a need arose for different religions to get to know the other on a human level. And that is a starting point of Rabbi Ted Falcon from his synagogue, Pastor Don McKenzie from his huge church in the university area, and then Interfaith Community Sanctuary. We got together and we just became friends we didn't realize we would bond together and be doing programs all over America and then even overseas. But because we became friends, people started calling us the Interfaith Amigos.
The TED Talk that the three of you did is one of my favorite videos and explanations of interfaith.
I want to tell you from the beginning, you have great taste. Congratulations.
Yeah, I like the Three Stooges too. So what have you learned from those years of being together? And were members of your own congregations curious about why is my spiritual leader hanging out with these other leaders?
No, they're very much in tune with the realization that if we really want genuine peace and understanding on our planet Earth, we've got to do the inconvenient work of getting to know the other on a human level, heart to heart. That's critical. But you know, Steve, to do that, I have to simultaneously do what is called the inner inconvenient work of becoming a more complete, developed human being, which means I have to transform my ego from a commanding master into a personal assistant. I have to purify and open my heart. So that inner work is critical. And then equally critical is the work of connecting with the other who is outside my tribe. I'm a Muslim. Mm-hmm. This is the majority Christian country. It is my sacred duty as a Muslim to bond with my brothers and sisters of the Christian faith. They're Jews here. They're Hindus. They're those who are spiritual but not religious. If I really believe in a cohesive, unified, loving, compassionate society, I have to bond with the other. You know, Mahatma Gandhi, this was his plea, his pleading and imploring. He would say, if you really want peace in a multi-religious society, which is the majority of the world, if you really want peace, it is your sacred duty to have an appreciative understanding of the other person's religion.
That's a beautiful concept. And what experience do you have when you travel and you lecture someplace where there's a very small Muslim minority and a less understanding or open majority? In the U.S., that would be Christian.
Even if I take it in another way, I have to connect with not only people who sing my song, being liberal, progressive, et cetera, et cetera. So for me as a Muslim, I make it a point to connect with very conservative Christians, brothers and sisters who really are allergic to Islam. Mm-hmm. And I have done that as an experiment which lasted several years. And I have very good, by now, Christian friends who are hardline Christian friends. And I found that the best way was really to persevere in my exertions with sincerity, with humility, with patience, to really connect with them again and again and again and again. And Steve, in the beginning, obviously they were very suspicious. They thought I'm trying to convert them. But as time went on, and as long as I am humble and sincere and patient and persevering, guess what? It took me a year to connect with these people who I would say were quite Islamophobic. As they got to know me, they lost their allergy about mm-hmm. Islam. But you know what the greatest learning was? I got to know them for their sense of community, servicing of one another, the relationship with another. I learned a lot about the love in a community. There is such a wonderful sense of really authentically helping the marginalized and living among them in foreign countries. See, I come from Bangladesh, and I'm so touched by those missionaries who go there, who have lived in the remote villages. And one couple I met spent 15 years living in the same state of poverty as they are, meaning no running water, no toilet facilities, etc., etc., and connecting with them. Of course, preaching the gospel of Jesus, that's wonderful, but being of service, I find that very heart-touching. So you see, I got changed in that sense of having a greater sense of inner spaciousness, inclusivity. I didn't realize in my progressive nature, I was narrow-minded. I was stereotyping. It took that personal connection to open me up.
Yeah. Well, you talked about being willing to do the inner inconvenient work, and that couple, of course, was doing it. They also did some very outer inconvenient work over those years. It's a blessing to the whole community when we can patiently listen. You said it took you a year to sort of work into a relationship, and that you learned, you feel, it sounds like, as much as they learned.
Absolutely. It's a two-way street in terms of being of service to one another and learning from one another.
Will you talk to me just a little bit? We hear about the Shia and the Sunni.
Yes.
We don't hear as much about the Sufi. Can you explain, sort of in a nutshell, Sufism?
You mentioned Shia and Sunni. Those are the two denominations in Islam, like Catholics and Protestants. Mm. 85% of Muslims are Sunnis, 15% are Shia. And it's based on a very sad historical fact about the choice of a successor. And just that dispute of who should be the community leader caused this division among the Muslims. Sufism is not a denomination like Shia or Sunni or Catholics and Protestants in Christianity. It is simply a heartfelt aspiration to live the religion, to live the spirit of the tradition, and not be too enmeshed in these theological beliefs and disputes that drains our energy and time. To be loving, to be of service, to do the inner inconvenient work, but have the heartfelt aspiration to live simply, not just talk about religion, debate about religion, fight about religion, kill over religion, but to live it. That's who Sufis are. But let me tell you where the confusion is, Steve. But there's a lot of confusion, because the question is, do you have to be a Muslim to be a Sufi? Because if you look around America, you'll find there are a lot of Sufis around, but in fact, the majority of Sufis in America are Jews. You have Christian Sufis. You have Hindu Sufis. You have spiritual but not religious Sufis. So the question is, do you have to be a Muslim to be a Sufi?
The answer is no.
No, exactly. But Sufis will just smile. They will say, they'll always explain by metaphor. They will say it's like this, you know, have you seen Muslims pray? Muslims always point their prayer rug in the direction of the Kaaba. Behind me is the direction of the Kaaba. Kaaba is that symbolic house of God in the Grand Mosque in Mecca. And all Muslims, they point their prayer rug in the direction of the Kaaba. A Sufi will say, what happens if you're enlightened, you're doing this inner inconvenient work, and metaphorically, your prayer rug is now inside the Kaaba. If it's inside the Kaaba, does it matter in what direction you point the prayer rug? No, you're already inside the Kaaba. So a Sufi is very open-minded. You can be espousing any religion. But if you're really doing the inner inconvenient work of becoming a more developed human being, more Christ-like, Buddha-like, Elohim-like, Allah-like, if you're doing that inner inconvenient work and you're of service to God's creation, you're a Sufi.
Well, that's beautifully explained. And what an image. If you're in there, where do you face?
That's right.
Sounds like you try and face God.
The Quran says God is outside of you and inside of you, inside your heart.
So, Imam, will you take me back to early days for you in Bangladesh and what you remember growing up about faith? And do you remember at some point you also had to adopt that? Like, is this my actual belief or just a tradition I'm part of?
You know, Steve, I was very lucky. I don't know how God assigns people in different cultures, families, countries, but I was born into a family where I spent very little time in Bangladesh, in those days called East Pakistan, because my parents were diplomats. That's one point. The other point is, particularly from my paternal side, my grandfather and his forefathers, they were wonderful healers and teachers of Islam. And my grandfather, for example, was a very well-known rural healer and preacher. You might say he was a Sufi, and I think he would call himself a Sufi, but a very learned theologian also. So I have that background of that lineage of Islamic spirituality. But because my parents were diplomats, I've lived in several parts of Europe, many parts of Middle East, depending on my father's postings. But for example, when I was very young, my parents were posted to Italy, and we had neighbors who were Catholics, and they loved us. And they would take me and my brother every Sunday for Catholic Mass. I have a memory of entering those churches and doing communion. And my parents would not object. My parents would just be open-minded. So because of my parents' travels, I've been to so many churches. In fact, people here, they joke and say, Jamal, you probably experienced communion more than we have, you know. As a child, I've been to synagogues. I've been to Hindu temples. I was always told by my parents, interfaith is not about conversion. It is about completion, becoming a more developed, complete human being. When your heart opens up, you realize there is so much inner spaciousness. It doesn't matter whether you're a Mormon or you're a Protestant or a Catholic or a Hindu or a Muslim or a Jew or no religion. You know, like Rumi says, come, come, whoever you are. Even if you've broken your vows 1,000 times, ours is a caravan of hope, not despair. Just come and join us, come and join us. So I developed that feeling of what many would say is at the core, at the heart of Islam. I'm not saying Muslims practice that, which is an inner spaciousness, mm-hmm. to be able to be inclusive. If I, as a Muslim, if I'm rooted in Islam, if I really believe my faith is very beautiful, and then if I study other religions, this expands my own understanding of my own religion. There's a very wonderful professor of religion called Houston Smith. He says, you can look at the Quran from one angle, the Islamic angle. But if you also look at the Quran from different angles, because you have studied different religions, you'll have a more complete, a deeper understanding of your own Quran, of your own religion. So I have found this is so true, which is why I'm able to speak with sincerity, humility, and people will believe me, I feel, because they know I'm sincere. I've done it myself. I say, I'm rooted in Islam, but believe me, if you study other religions and their practices, you'll become a better Muslim.
This is In Good Faith. We'll be back in just a moment with more. Hi, Stephen Cap Perry here, host of In Good Faith. Here's another podcast from our BYU Radio family of podcasts I hope you'll check out. What I Love is Real. You know that saying, real recognize real? That's Lisa on The Lisa Show. Lisa Valentine Clark is a comedian, she's a believer, a single mother, and on The Lisa Show podcast, you'll hear from the Council of Moms, a genius idea which is actually one of my favorite parts of her show. And you'll hear about the challenges of life, parenting, mental health questions, social issues. Yes, you'll hear from experts, but also from people discussing their where the rubber meets the road life experience. It's The Lisa Show, wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back to In Good Faith. We're speaking with Imam Jamal Rahman of the Seattle-based Interfaith Community Sanctuary.
I'm wondering if it's even possible, but can you put your finger on why you believe in God? Is that a feeling or experience?
God is an experience. Of course, we're told there is a God, this and that, you know. For me, I've had my own experiences, but I must tell you, there was one Christian poem that really touched my heart. Oh, almond tree, oh, sister almond tree, tell me about God. And the almond tree blossomed. So nature can really help you realize. Mm. And then there's the verses in the Quran, which have really given me a feeling of Allah. So for example, there's a verse in the Quran that says, if all the trees in this universe became pens, and all the seven oceans became ink, and you began to write out the mysteries of God, and the oceans became depleted, you started all over again, you wouldn't come closer describing a fraction of the fraction of the fraction of God's mysteries. Now Rumi, when he read this, we believe, he uttered those famous words about God, about the invisible world, sell your cleverness and buy bewilderment. That had a deep impact on me. So when I study different religions, in Taoism, they say about God, those who say do not know, and those who know do not say. So that touched me a lot. Then I studied Hinduism, and I love the saying in Hinduism, what is God? The mind cannot think it, but it is that by which the mind thinks. The eyes cannot see it, but it is that by which the eyes see. The tongue cannot utter it, but is that by which the tongue utters? So for me, I realize It is an experience. Are you familiar with Hafiz, 14th century Sufi sage Hafiz? He says, you have to taste through your own experience what is called the glow of presence. I felt the glow of presence when my parents passed away, the tragedy of my parents passing away. In that tragic moment or moments, I felt the glow of presence, a guidance, a support, a healing, a nurturance. So for me, it's okay if people say they don't believe in God. It's an experience. You'll have to have that experience.
I would love to ask how all these years you keep going when it may at times feel like pushing against an immovable object, and yet you push.
Thank you for that wonderful question, because I've examined that myself. I've always wondered what gives me the greatest joy and the greatest support in times of despair. We all have our ups and downs. It's a world of opposites. There is joy, there's bound to be sorrow. I would say two things. One is having wonderful relationship with core family members. That is a key for me. By grace of God, I have a very close-knit family, and every one of us is of extensive support to one another. That's one. And the other one is having good friends, genuine community. What Rumi calls, please come out of the circle of time and enter the circle of love. That circle could be from your family and all from your friends, but it's a close-knit group with whom you can be vulnerable, with whom you can share spiritual practices. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he always insisted, have these spiritual companions. That's critical, because to grow in life, you have to have this circle with whom you can be vulnerable and with whom you can grow through sharing of spiritual practices. Find friends who love the truth. And that's, of course, is a very open-minded word, you know, truth. But if it resonates and you're living the truth and feeling the truth and expressing the truth, I'm growing. I'm having the ingredients for becoming a more complete human being.
And that seems to be a foundation upon which you can keep doing the work, whether it's
absolutely
convenient or not.
Very well said. If there are moments of despair, hopelessness, deaths happen, hopes are dashed, terrible things happen, there's family, there is friends, and I can keep doing my prayers, my inner inconvenient work of transforming my ego, opening up my heart, and having the support all around me. That is critical.
Do you have time for just another question or two?
Absolutely. I have all the time. Yes.
Have you been able to make Hajj?
I have performed the Hajj, but not because I was so eager to do it. It's only because, by chance, my father was posted to Saudi Arabia. And in those days, the capital was Jeddah. And Mecca is not far away. So I remember every Friday, or most Fridays, we used to drive down to Mecca, where the Kaaba is. You know, you could, in those days, spend nights in the Grand Mosque. So I've been to Mecca close to 100 times, and then performed the Hajj also. But I can tell you this much, Steve. I remember as a child, just about 10 years old, I think, if I remember correctly, spending nights in the Kaaba. In those days, I did not know that much about Islam. I remember the sense of heartfelt awe, spending nights, especially moonlit nights, and staring at the Kaaba and feeling what we have described before, that glow of presence. I felt it as a child. Simply being in the presence of that historical place and staring at the Kaaba late at night. And I would talk to people around me, and some were very old people. And some came from our part of the world. I would talk to them, and they would say they have married off their children. They have taken care of their wife, meaning discharge of earthly responsibilities. And they're here now in their old age. And their greatest joy and wish is simply to die in Kaaba, in Mecca. So I felt their sacred fervor, that the perfume, the fragrance of their heartfelt connection with God, with Muhammad, with the prophets. And that rubbed off on me. At that time, I felt, wow, what an experience. That was my Hajj, spending nights as a child in presence of the grand house of God called the Kaaba.
A truly unique privilege and experience as a child. I see why it sticks in your memory.
Yes, yes. I savor that memory again and again and again.
Imam Rahman, is there something you want to be sure that you share with us?
I usually end my sermons with this one saying of the Prophet Muhammad, if I may. I'd like to say it to you also. When you arrived here from the invisible world, everybody around you was laughing and smiling, but you were crying and weeping when you entered this world. Live such a life that when you depart, everybody around you is crying and weeping, but you are laughing and smiling. I wish this for myself and for you and for every member of your community and also my community.
You just heard Imam Jamal Rahman talking about interfaith and finding community. One thing I really loved from his discussion was the inner inconvenient work of getting to know the other, meaning people who are maybe different from you or believe different things, and also just personal growth and development. And he talks about how interfaith is less about conversion, is more about becoming more complete. You know, learning about other people also helps you become a better person.
I was thinking of the Rumi quote he gave and the invitation to be part of a caravan of hope. We need that. We need that really bad, but that it's an invitation and we do have to act. And listening to him talk about how he didn't just make an effort like, it would be good if I knew people in the community of other faiths, but they just became his true and real friends. And I've had that experience a few times. And I love that feeling. I love loving people who are different than me in important ways. And that's that caravan of belonging. We're grateful to Imam Jamal Rahman for speaking with us today. Our episode was produced by Aaliyah Ebert and Josh Orton. Our production team also includes Heather Bigley, Leah King, Katarina Martinich, and James Sturdivant. Our post-production sound designers are Lauren Sandberg and Brandon Lewis. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. Is interfaith understanding important to you? Would you like to be an interfaith amigo? Be sure and leave a comment or review on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts, and help us spread the word. Find us on social media, too. Twitter is In Good Faith Pod, Instagram and Facebook, In Good Faith Podcast, and videos on YouTube at youtube.com/@in-good-faith. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here in Good Faith.